Yes, it's been a long time since we've had Linda Moulton Howe on for a complete program. When we come back, we'll continue with some of your phone calls. She'll pick up on this cat mutilation story again. Next hour, we will reserve entirely to conversations with Linda, all your phone calls. And then she still has another report on the weakened American honeybees as well. So we'll be back with Linda. We'll let her wrap up on the cat mutilation story when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast, George Norhue with Linda Moulton Howe. We'll take some of your calls, but Linda, let's let you wrap up the cat mutilation story, if you would, please.
Thanks, George. One thing I would like our audience to know, especially those who might be in the Fort Worth, Dallas area, that the community there, it's called De Cordova Bend Estates. They have now a $4,600 reward offered for information that would lead to the arrest and conviction of the perpetrator. And there at Earth Files, in my report, I have a number for the Hood County Sheriff's Office, the investigator who is trying to follow up on these third cats, and for people in Fort Worth and for in the Dallas area to know that if you have any information, that the Hood County Sheriff's Office is the place to go to, mail or call. And this $4,600 reward is being offered through the De Cordova Bend Estates management office there. And if anybody does have any information, rather than giving out a variety of phone numbers and contacts to these various places, the easiest thing would be to email me, earthfiles@earthfiles.com, and I can get in touch with the authorities. And for those listening, every time you hear Earth Files, think of a reporter filing news about the Earth, earthfiles@earthfiles.com. And finally, George, just to bring it full circle and perhaps to place this very difficult subject that I think, frankly, falls into the same category as the global larger animal mutilations, but they are smaller and it's a cat that we have a great personal affection for. And that makes it even more difficult. But I just wanted to end this on this subject for the audience listening to know that on August 13th, 1989, the August New York Times reported about 67 cats found mutilated in Tustin, California, which is a suburb of Los Angeles near Santa Ana. And this is from the New York Times, 1989. Quote, some of the cats were cut in half with what some say is almost surgical precision. Others disemboweled or skinned. One resident said, quote, there is never any blood at the scene. The animals are often dismembered with surgical precision, and paws and other body parts are often left on the ground in strikingly similar arrangements. No one ever seems to hear anything, nor do dogs bark during the killing. It was believed the cats are captured, taken elsewhere, their blood drained, and organs removed, and then their bodies replaced on their owner's lawn, unquote, New York Times.
All right, Linda, thank you so much. Let's go to some more calls. Let's go east of the Rockies. You're on the air with Linda Moulton Howe. Hi there.
Good morning, George. Good morning, Ms. Howe.
Hi.
My question pertains to the cattle mutilations. I saw that your investigators found an abnormal amount of magnetite at several sites.
Right. That's absolutely true. You're talking about biophysicist W.C. Levengood. He, like John Altshuler, started working with me on animal mutilations back, well, on cattle. The first case we looked at was in Kansas, and I think that was around 1994. And it was about the same time that in England, in a very particular crop formation that I had been over there, that a man decided to take a magnet and go through the English crop formation and ended up with all of this stuff clinging to his magnet, gathered it up, and sent it to W.C. Lovingood in Michigan.
Yes.
That was the first hard evidence of the high amount of magnetite in the crop formation, and it is what led us to study the soils at animal mutilations, and in some cases, we have been surprised to find also elevated magnetite.
Well, certain species of ants continuously collect, store for navigation, and expel magnetite. And I was just wondering if there was any way that that was tested, that it was laid down by ants, because if you eliminate all other possibilities, of course, you only have one left. I really appreciate your thorough and no-nonsense investigation style. Thank you, and I'll take the answer off the air.
Very good.
Thank you, sir. What you're missing is the experience in the laboratory that I've had with W.C. Lovingood in Michigan, in which the first time that I got to see the sprayed on iron, it was all over the plants. It was like you had taken a can of spray paint and you had sprayed these wheat stalks and the delicate spraying, so that he could take a seed and put it on the lab table and take a magnet, and that seed, or even the sheath around the seed, if you separated it out, would jump up to the magnet. There was that much. And this was, so we're talking about spray. Now, what led W.C. Lovingood then to do a great deal of research, and this was all published in the very, very highly credible Physiologia Plantarum, which is probably the world's most respected botanical journal that is published in Europe. And in there, he laid out this work on analysis in crop formations, the high amount of magnetite in the spraying of what appears to be like a red iron spray on the plants. And this is what led him to the hypothesis that perhaps in cattle mutilations, the cat mutilations, I set into, how to put this, a category in which yet, so far, I have never heard a single eyewitness describe ever seeing any link between the half cats or the third cats and something like a beam of light, as we have had many reports in the large animals. Okay, but why is this significant? If a biophysicist is able to study and prove that there was, up in one case, up to 750 times the amount of magnetite in the soil of one particular incident, and then he works backward from what he's finding in the hard physical evidence and hypothesizes that what could produce this spray that is going on to the ground and into the plants. And then he says, okay, we've got meteoritic dust up in the atmosphere of this planet constantly. And part of the hypothesis is that whatever is making the crop formations and perhaps interacting with the animals is using some kind of a technology that is taking advantage of our electromagnetic fields and applying plasmas that are put into a vortex that could be part of the beam technology, could be part of what puts crop circles down, and that if it's high in the atmosphere, wherever this is begun, the spinning plasma, it would churn down through the natural meteoritic dust in the upper atmosphere, and when these burst events, when it actually interacts with the plants, the soil, so forth, that it would then release what essentially would be melted and magnetized iron. That has been a working hypothesis now for nearly a decade, and we have continued to find this higher content of magnetite both at the animal mutilation site as well as crop formation.
Linda, I want to compliment you, by the way, on just the incredible presence you bring to this program, and you have over so many years. But more importantly now, as this earth continues to change, your reports, I think, are so important.
Well, thank you.
And you're right there for us.
Thank you so much, because I really believe in the pressure of fact and trying to avoid being trapped by that something is not politically acceptable, therefore don't investigate it. I have never bought into that. And I will try as hard as I can to keep bringing to Coast and to Earth Files the pressure of fact on all of these Earth mysteries, regardless of what is considered to be politically acceptable.
Next up, let's go to Wildcard Line. You're on Coast to Coast with Linda Moulton Howe. Hi there.
Hey, George. Good evening. Good evening, Linda.
Hi.
Hi, and thank you for all your years of your brave research, Linda. You know, it's a rare thing what you deal with, and you're probably the most thorough researcher out there, especially from what I've heard, and I have followed you a fair amount through the years, in the areas of what you've been discussing here, in the area of the cattle mutilations and animal mutilations in general, and then the other area of human abductions. UFO abductions.
Yeah.
And I have a great curiosity about what you may think the overall objectives are, if any, that are discernible, or even things that could be speculated upon as possible objectives as far as these two phenomena go. And one other question would be, how far back in our recorded history do the animal mutilations go? And I sure appreciate the great program, and I'll listen on the radio, and thank you.
All right, Mark, thank you.
And thank you. I'll start with your last question first. How far back do the reported animal mutilations go? When I was sitting at my desk for the very first phone calls back in September of 1979, it seems almost just like yesterday to me in some ways. I started reaching out in a lot of different directions, and one of them was to England and to the BBC, because I respect a lot of their reporting, and I know that in going to outside of the United States, that I needed to find out if a very reputable media organization like that had files on animal mutilation. And to my surprise at the time, and this is all the way back to September of 79, because that's when I started very very hard trying to get to the bottom of the global animal mutilation mystery, I talked to a producer at the BBC who said that they had a report printed in a journal that the BBC had at one time, the producer knew, going back to 1904 in Australia on the Billabong, and that there was a report of 111 sheep, if I'm remembering correctly, that had been found dead, all of the same tissue excised, and no blood on all of that white hair of those sheep, and that it had registered with the farm owner to the extent that there had been enough conversation about it that it got reported and the BBC had that journal. Well, I worked hard, and I worked with that producer trying to get it. I really, if anybody listening anywhere has this 1904 journal about all of these sheep in Australia, I have always wanted to see it. Well, okay, so that may be the first reported, but unfortunately we don't have the physical journal. Then you jump to the 1940s, because now in the Majestic 12 documents that Bob Wood and Ryan Wood have worked so hard on over the last 10, 12, 14 years, in some of the reports, it talks very specifically about what was found in three crash sites between July 2nd and July 5th, 1947, not just the one near Corona. And it specifies that three objects came down essentially shaped the same way, not round, not disc, but shaped like a wedge of pie. and that at the Corona website, or at the Corona site that they called Landing Zone 1, I believe, there were supposed to be, and this is a quote from the Majestic 12 documents, bodies dissected as one would a frog. Those words are literally in these Majestic 12 documents. Then it says at Landing Zone 2, which was at the Trinity site or near the Trinity site in the northern part of White Sands, then it was the proving grounds. Today it's the missile range in southern New Mexico. That at that that crash site, the vehicle was not damaged very much, and that they found non-human bodies on the outside and on the inside of the vehicle. It says in the report that there were animal parts found in containers inside of this vehicle.
Jeez.
So you've got bodies dissected as one would a frog at the Corona site, but it doesn't specify, are they non-human bodies? Are they animal bodies? Are they human bodies? Then you have at White Sands the description of animal parts specifically having been found. And in the third site, which was 30 miles east of Alamogordo, near the Mescalero Indian Reservation, it says specifically that the vehicle, which they said was shaped like the others, but was so damaged they could not tell a lot from it. Now, that's all in these Majestic 12 documents. And, of course, we're talking about 47. And if this is all true, then it means that President Harry S. Truman was dealing with data coming to him about, we're saying mutilations today. They talked about it as bodies dissected and dissected animal parts. Now, if you then go to the 1950s to 60s, you come to the work of Lieutenant Colonel Philip J. Corso, who wrote the very important book, The Day After Roswell. And before he died in 1998, he had sat down with me twice in long conversations about what he had seen concerning animal mutilations and many other subjects. And he said, Linda, I saw highly classified documents with my own eyes about global unusual animal deaths, bloodless, trackless, all of the same excisions taken, northern hemisphere, southern hemisphere, and the perpetrators were named in our own classified government documents with dates as early as 1951 that he saw, 1951, as, quote, extraterrestrial biological entity. If our government has known all of this for 60-some years, it is the last subject that they want anybody reporting about because they are afraid of panic, they can't control it, and it doesn't stop. To me, you don't turn away from that, from anything that you don't understand. You try to understand as much about it and report it, because I personally believe it is only with knowledge that we are strong, and it is when we are lied to and deceived and everything is covered up and manipulated by government forces that the population becomes weaker and weaker.
All right, Linda, hold on. We'll be right back on Coast to Coast AM with Linda Moulton Howe. We had to push her into this break a little too quickly, Linda. Sorry, but we must go. We'll be back. Next hour, we'll have conversations with Linda. We'll also take some of your calls this hour. She still has the report on the honeybees when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Linda, we'll take a few calls, and then we'll get into your honeybee story.
Okay.
We'll pick it up by going to our first-time caller line. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi.
Yeah.
How are you?
We are
George
fine.
And Linda?
Yes.
My name is Melissa, and I have a couple of, well, I have a theory, actually, on the Peru meteor.
Mm-hmm.
Does it necessarily have to be heat that boiled the water? Could it Could it have been something like when you put like dry ice in water, how it boils?
Yes.
Could it have been something like that?
That's why maybe you didn't hear earlier when I was saying I had asked him about whether or not that silica could actually get hot enough to boil. And the other option is some sort of a chemical reaction between something that was on the meteorite and that water coming into the hole. So you can have a chemical reaction that can look like boiling, or you can have heat boiling. So you're essentially on the right track. What they don't know yet is what would have caused that effect and why would people have gotten sick.
Well, and the thing I was wondering, too, is does the arsenic have to be in the soil, or could it have been in the dry ice, so to speak, for lack of a better word?
the meteorite itself appears to be largely silicate with a little bit of iron inclusions is what they call them. That would be the metallic part. Mm-hmm. So usually you don't think of silicate as heating up. In fact, you would think of silicate more as an insulator. And that is a puzzle. The water, we don't know yet. It may turn out that all of these advanced statements by spaceweather.com, which is a NASA group, National Geographic, somebody is jumping on this arsenic in the soil before the scientists have released a report, and that may be what it turns out to be, that maybe there is a deposit of arsenic there. That would not be normal. I mean, soil would not normally have some large deposit of arsenic.
Well, I hope not.
But that is what makes this so interesting. And everybody stay tuned to Earth Files, because as soon as I have the final report, Dr. Macharé said he would let me know, and it'll be tomorrow or Friday if they are on schedule, and I will report everything that they have on what they've found. So go to Earth Files.
Let's go west of the Rockies. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi, Derek.
Hi, this is Daniel from Tucson.
Hi, Daniel. Thank
Hi,
you.
Hi, Linda. Listen, Herbert Shermer, that Nebraska State Patrolman?
Yes.
I was wondering if somewhere down the road you could, like, do a report on that, because I had an older book by a Ralph and Judy Blum, and I don't know how credible they were, but they made some claims in this book which were kind of interesting, and I was wondering if you could comment on it.
Well, I am familiar with the Blum's work, also about Earth Mysteries, and I think that they have done credible work. I'm familiar with the Herbert Shermer case, and what I don't know, and if anybody listening can help me, I don't know where he lives now. I'm assuming he is alive. This was an event, I believe, in the 60s, late 60s.
Right, right.
And so he should be alive. If Herbert Shermer is listening and he could get in touch with me at earthfiles@earthfiles.com, or if somebody knows where he is, I would be more than happy to follow up, because I have always thought that was a fascinating story.
Well, myself as well, because I had a story related to me by a member of the Apache Nation about a year ago, which very closely coincided with something in the book that he said that they showed him. And he said that they had hovered near a power line, and this antenna came out, touched the power line, and he said he watched the dials sort of recharge their batteries or whatever they were. And I had a friend that, like I say, from the Apache Nation, who was talking about another native that he knew, and he said the guy told him the story that he was out hunting, and he was by some huge power lines that, you know, run through the, I guess, the Apache Nation. Anyways, to make a long story short, he said that he saw this craft do the same thing, this sort of thing come out of the bottom, touch the power line, and then he said it just left. So that's why I was kind of asking you that question, if you knew anything more about it. You know?
Well, there have been many, many eyewitness accounts of seeing something that was either disc-shaped or round or cigar-shaped or something aerial and not the way we think of aviation, hovering over power lines over decades, extending rods as if there is some extraction of electricity. The same thing has been seen at water holes, lakes, with this beam technology that looks translucent to so many people who have seen it. It is described as being a beam that you can slightly see through, but that it is filled with particles that seem to glitter inside. Everybody describes it the same way, as if there is a texture to whatever this beam technology is, and it has been seen raising water, raising cut sections out of lakes, as well as animals. And so the idea that it is a technology that may use water and certainly can have access to our electrical power grid whenever it wants to has been part of the phenomena for years and years. And I'm realizing that there was a gentleman in the previous half hour who asked me what I thought might be behind, let's say, the human abduction syndrome, which we're talking now about with Herbert Schirmer, and the global animal mutilation. And the one thing about all this is we're dealing with advanced technology. What appears to us in some cases perhaps as ghosts are actually holographic projections or molecular projections using a technology that if we would open our minds, we could learn so much, because we are not dealing with paranormal. We are dealing with physical advanced technology. And in that regard, there appears to be a harvest of genetic material is part of the agenda. My own struggle is to understand from government sources, there are at least three main groups. And as far as I know, they don't all get along. If are all of them taking using the earth like a supermarket or a territory, or is there competition? Are there mixed motives, mixed agendas? This is why this is so complicated and difficult, because as one man years ago said to me, he said, Linda, I've come to think about humans as being something like the 37th model of a vacuum cleaner on the earth. And that which has set us in motion, has overseen the seeding of life here, seems to know about a big picture, but that the various models of the vacuum cleaners don't have a clue. And that right now, we may be more aware in 2007 than a lot of previous generations or previous hominids, but that we have been very specifically kept in the dark from what it is are these bigger agendas. And animal mutilations, an extraction of water and electricity from power lines, is part of the agenda. And to what end, that's what we would all like to know.
Okay, great. Linda, let's go on with our honeybee update, and then we'll continue with our calls.
This is really has become both sad and more fascinating. Sad because today I talk with Jerry Hayes, who I have interviewed before on Coast, and he's the chief of the apiary, which is the bee section in the Florida Department of Agriculture, and he's also the president of the Apiary Inspectors of America, and he's based in Gainesville, Florida. He really has his fingers in mind on the pulse of everything that is happening. He had Israeli scientists visiting him 2 weeks ago, and I put at my Earth Files report this quote from him today. The bees are in a weakened state. They've had a rough season, so there aren't as many bees in the colonies now as one would expect at this time of the year. And he went on to explain the beekeepers throughout the United States and at least Canada, they are all saying the same thing. They're not seeing good, strong, healthy bees. And it was only about 3 weeks ago, on September 7th, that the Science Express, which is the electronic online website of the very prestigious journal Science, published this report about the discovery that when they have taken the bodies that have been studied by Penn State, the University of Pennsylvania, University of Illinois, and so forth, from around where the bees have disappeared in a few colonies, they have found dead bees, and this is what the scientists have used as a cross-section in from several states to look at these bodies and see if they could find a common denominator. And through this whole past several months, A lot of candidates have come up, and on September 7th, what was published was in 96% of all of the CCD-related fees, they confirmed this thing called Israeli acute paralysis virus. Well, this is really complicated because it wasn't before 2002 to 2003 that Israel identified this very virus, that's why the name Israel is attached to it, in their own honeybees that were struggling at the time to survive, because Israel was also fighting this Varroa mite that really hit beekeepers in the United States hard at the end of the 80s. Well, Israel got it big time in 2002 to 2003, and while they are looking at their honeybees trying to find out what they're going to do because they're all dying, they find this virus. Well, what happens now? We get to 2004, 2 years after Israel identifies this odd virus. And in 2004, our own American Department of Agriculture decided to open up honeybee imports into the United States. And this was the first time this had ever been allowed in 83 years. We had not been allowing in foreign insects and honeybees and pollinators. Well, there was a lot of argument at that time in 2004 that if the Department of Agriculture let in foreign bees on top of a population of honeybees that had been struggling with this terrible Varroa mite, which comes out of Asia, and our bees were hit like a Mack truck by this Asian mite. They had no evolutionary genetic resistance to it whatsoever. Well, the Department of Agriculture, it decides that they'll let them in. And Jerry Hayes told me that he was against it, and that in fact, and here is a quote from my Earth Files, he says, when the Australian bees were first approved to be brought into the United States in 2004 by the Department of Agriculture's, it's an APHIS division, animals, plants, and all of that, that's the division that decides what comes in and out of this country. I told APHIS I wanted to quarantine these bees coming in from Australia. I would quarantine them in Florida, let them establish themselves, and then have my inspectors inspect the bees to see if there was anything we should be concerned about. And I was told that if I did this, I would be interfering with international trade.
What?
And that I would be sued. This is the chief of the apiary division in the Department of Agriculture in Florida in 2004, who wanted to at least quarantine the very first imported bees from Australia to see if there would be any problem. And he gets threatened that it would be a violation of international trade and he would be sued by somebody in the federal government. So he said, I backed off, and the next thing we know is that in 2006, 25% of the honeybee colonies in the United States, Canada, and the reports out of Europe in areas like Spain, that they've disappeared in this new version of some kind of an attack on pollinators known as colony collapse disorder. Well, now, this is so interesting. They have now been able to confirm that this same Israeli paralyzing virus that was found in 96% of the North American bees affected by CCD, this virus is also in the Australian bees that we have been importing for the last 3 years. But in Australia, the virus doesn't cause the bees to disappear. And now what they're beginning to think, there's a lot more research needed, but this is like describing, George, dominoes of how complicated and interrelated everything always is in life forms. They think because the Australian bees have never, ever had to deal with the Varroa mite, that they've never been weakened like the North American bees or the ones in Israel or Spain, and that there was a perfect storm, a confluence of challenge with the varroa mite. These new neonicotinoid pesticides are also a problem. And in comes a virus in bees that our own Department of Agriculture allows into the country without any quarantine and without any testing, even with advice by people of apiary expertise saying they should be quarantined before they are let loose into the United States.
God, what's the matter with these people, Linda?
You know, George, this is a question, don't you think, that everybody is asking now about the priorities inside of our government seem to be so upside down and backwards, and that how do we get this country back to where people working in our government actually give a flip about the consequences of their decisions?
By the way, listen to this story that Tom sends me. He says, Tom Cruise and Katie Holmes are planning to build a multi-million dollar bunker under their Colorado home to protect them from alien attacks.
Are you serious?
No, a source close to Cruise. Boy, Tommy, I hope this is not a joke. I'm reading this verbatim. A source close to Cruise, who's a leading Scientologist, said the actor is to erect a self-contained underground system where up to 10 people can survive for years. The bunker will reportedly include a high-tech air purification system. Followers of Scientology are thought to believe an evil galactic overlord named Xenu is planning to invade the planet in an act of revenge. Now, that I've never heard of.
Well, I've heard about, of course, Battlestar Galactica comes right from the founder of Scientology, and that was how Scientology evolved.
L. Ron Hubbard, right?
Yes, and that was based on this whole idea that there is this war in the universe. But I'm going to step back for you and for the audience a little bit and say, if we have had the presence of at least three different kinds of non-humans at least using this planet, wherever they are based, they may be based underground on this planet.
Sure.
They may be based on the moon. They may have bases throughout our solar system, other solar systems. The exact source, I have no idea. But if you look at the evolutionary history of this planet, and if you look at some of the Majestic 12 documents that suggest that there has been interaction with Earth life for millennia, long before Homo sapien, perhaps, there is no indication that there has ever been any intent to destroy humans. The genetic harvest of animals, and clearly sperm and eggs from the human abduction syndrome, falls into a category that is considered to be intrusive without question by humans.
We'll be back with Linda Moulton Howe in a second. Those of you who want to chat with her about this topic as well, feel free, because the entire hour now, conversations with Linda.